I'm Jennifer Westaway.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
John Kerry and John Edwards are apparently hitting the road running. A USA Today CNN Gallup poll out today shows John Edwards with a 54% favorable rating compared to Vice President Dick Cheney's 43%. And 57% of voters asked said 51-year-old Edwards is qualified to serve as president if need be. At their first official photo op this morning, Senator Kerry called today the beginning of a conversation that is hopeful and positive. And then Senator Edwards spoke.
Well, I can say this. For my family, I want him to be our next president. There is so much at stake. He shares the values and the vision that I believe in.
The pair kick off a four-day barnstorming tour that will end this weekend in Edwards' own North Carolina, one of the states President Bush is campaigning in today. Well, joining us on the line on his cell phone from the Kerry campaign is Jeff Zeleny. He's national political correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. Hi, Jeff.
Hi there.
Well, tell us, how are they getting along?
Well, so far so good. The first sighting of the two as a political pair was rather brief and picturesque. It was on Teresa Hines Kerry's sprawling estate outside Pittsburgh. I mean, it was a beautiful morning with a grassy green meadow, flowers in bloom. The children were smiling. So it was just the picture they were looking for, but not much substance. The substance will come later in the day.
Was there any sense of what Howard Feynman once wrote, that John Kerry treated John Edwards as if he should be sitting at the kiddie table?
During the primary, it often seemed like that was the situation, but it almost seems like it's a little bit the other way now. You know, yesterday when he announced his choice, he said, you know, John Edwards is ready for the job. John Edwards is ready for the job. And he repeated the same thing again this morning, so I think we'll hear that. I was a little surprised he sort of keeps saying that because it, you know, might leave the impression in people's minds that he's not. But it was very cordial, and very, you know, welcoming on both sides. And they began hinting at the message that they'll be talking about, which is, you know, this theme of two Americas. And, you know, some in the middle class have been left out under the Bush administration.
Which was John Edwards' theme during his campaign for president. Well, you know, the reason that John Kerry raises that point might be that that's the question that's being asked. The Washington Post writing today that the big question has to be, is John Edwards ready to be president, the job of a vice president, if in fact he's called? And they write, we can't yet answer with a resounding affirmative. So is perhaps John Kerry responding to that caution?
I mean, I think he is, and I think there is sort of the question that people have is, what has changed in the last few months since John Kerry, you know, basically said John Edwards was not qualified? I mean, why is he ready now? But they're really, you know, trying to showcase them both as a team, and all systems are go in the first few hours anyway.
You referred to the lack of substance in this morning's photo opportunity and the expectation there might be more today. What might we see?
I mean, we're traveling to Ohio and Florida. First stop Cleveland and then Dayton, Ohio. I mean, I think one of the things we're going to hear is just the beginning of this American journey, they're calling it. They're really trying to focus on the segment of America, the segment of the electorate that feels left behind, that feels that they're looking for more hope. And the word hope was one that was repeated again and again this morning by John Edwards and John Kerry. So I think we'll hear a lot of hopeful, optimistic language, which it was one thing the Bush campaign had said the Kerry campaign is not. So one of the things they're trying to do is indeed look optimistic.
We're also seeing, of course, the Republican response. They immediately rolled out an ad that pointed out that Edwards was Kerry's second choice after John McCain, and also raised questions about John Edwards' experience and the fact that he was a trial lawyer. Any response to that from the Kerry campaign?
Well, the Kerry campaign is, and the Democratic National Committee is rolling out a John McCain ad of their own. And they're pointing out that John McCain, indeed, is not always stood side by side with the president. The McCain commercial has a very small ad buy, which means that not that many people will see it. So at this point, it's just the early jockeying of, you know, who can be closer to John McCain because he's a popular figure. But I think we'll get beyond that in the next few days.
Well, Jeff, it sounds like it's getting a little rowdy there on the bus.
It is. The noise you're hearing is indeed the noise from the what's called the real deal, John Kerry's plane, which has the newly painted Edwards logo on the side.
Yeah. And the herd of press trying to catch up with him. Well, Jeff, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jeff Zeleny, national political correspondent for the Chicago Tribune, speaking to us on his cell phone from the Kerry campaign.
It may be the Granite State, but votes in New Hampshire are far from set in stone this year. It's a crucial swing state for Republicans and Democrats looking to win the White House. 4 years ago, New Hampshire was the only state in the Northeast to vote for George W. Bush. So will the newly minted team of Kerry and Edwards sway voters to go Democratic this time round? WBUR's Fred Tice went to Portsmouth, New Hampshire to find out.
President Bush won New Hampshire by just 7,000 votes. If those votes had gone the other way, giving Gore New Hampshire, the state's four electoral votes would have given Gore the election, Florida or not. In the last University of New Hampshire poll of likely voters released in May, Kerry was leading Bush 49% to 45%. So the state is clearly in play. In downtown Plymouth, a Democratic stronghold, voters seem largely determined to vote for Kerry anyway, but they seem more excited about it now that Edwards is on the ticket. Courtney Dennison says Kerry's choice of a running mate has made her want to vote for him now.
Actually, I didn't like Kerry for a long time. I thought he was kind of a weasel. But when he announced Edwards as his running mate, I was really happy because in the New Hampshire primaries, I voted for Edwards, and I actually really liked him. So that kind of sways my vote.
Sipping a coffee with a friend in Market Square, filmmaker Dan Freund says he's also determined to vote for Kerry anyway, but he says Edwards should energize the Kerry campaign.
John Kerry seems to have let himself be written by the Bush team, and I think that John Edwards will add some energy and start to redefine the campaign and redefine what the American presidency is all about.
Even longtime Republican Joe Webb, determined to vote for Bush, thinks Kerry made a good move by picking Edwards.
Edwards would have been my choice if I were going to go Democrat. I much prefer him over Kerry. So, I mean, ultimately, I'm going to go Bush, but I think this is going to help him. I think it's going to pick up a nice broad base for him.
Pollster Andy Smith isn't so sure.
I don't think that the choice of John Edwards is going to be particularly strong for or against Kerry in New Hampshire, mainly because the New Hampshire electorate is not the kind of electorate that really warmed up to John Edwards' message.
Smith is the director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. He's conducting a new presidential preference poll right now.
The New Hampshire electorate up here, for the most part, are upper income. They are highly educated, high-income folks. And the blue-collar message that Edwards was pushing isn't something that particularly is strong up here.
Smith says good evidence of that is Edwards' fourth-place finish in the New Hampshire primary. Still, 4 out of 10 New Hampshire voters are independents, and political scientist Dante Scala of St. Anselm College says Edwards did well among independents in primaries across the country last winter.
If you look back on the exit polls in various Democratic primaries, it was John Edwards who did very well among more independent-minded voters, more so than John Kerry. And in fact, analysts were saying during the spring, wouldn't John Edwards be a better candidate than John Kerry, precisely because he's appealing more to middle-of-the-road independent voters. So in New Hampshire, in the fall, it'll be very interesting to see whether John Edwards can enhance John Kerry's standing, not just among Democrats, where Kerry is already very solid, but among those undeclared voters.
Scala says it's a fact of life for Democrats in New Hampshire that in order to win a statewide election, you have to poll upwards of 55% of that undeclared vote.
WBUR's Fred Tice reporting from New Hampshire.
As expected, the Iraqi government today announced a new national safety law giving Prime Minister Iyad Alawi the right to impose broad martial powers when he deems it necessary. The announcement came as masked gunmen battled Iraqi police and soldiers in central Baghdad. At least 4 people were killed. Also today, mortars landed near the home and office of the prime minister, and police defused a massive car bomb elsewhere in the city. Joining us from Baghdad is Anya Cizadlo of the Christian Science Monitor. And Anya, what kind of powers does this law give Alawi?
He can declare martial law in either nationwide or in certain parts of the country. And once he does declare it, there's a number of things he can do. He can cordon off particular areas. He can take control of police and security forces. He can monitor and limit communications. So that includes both mail and telecommunications. He can seize assets of people suspected of being insurgents or suspected of giving aid to insurgents. And there's several other things, but those are pretty much the main ones.
Are there any checks and balances to offset the fears that this would just be another Saddam Hussein regime?
It's an interesting question because there are now. I got a leaked copy of the law several days ago, back when they were originally going to announce it, and there weren't. They've scheduled the unveiling of the law a couple of times and canceled it a couple of times. Finally, on the third try, they did unveil it with a couple of checks and balances included. And I've heard from Iraqi government sources that there was some last-minute pressure to include these checks and balances.
The pressure from who?
I've heard from Iraqi government sources that there was pressure from both Iraqis and from the U.S. Mm-hmm. to include some of the checks and balances. The key one being that the martial law, once declared, has to be periodically renewed, which is important because it keeps it from dragging on for, you know, years or even decades at a time.
Iraq's human rights minister has likened this new law to the Patriot Act in the U.S. How are Iraqis reacting to it?
Well, people are pretty divided. I mean, everyone is desperate for something, anything that will stop the violence. And so people seem very willing to give martial law a chance. A lot of people have said to me, look, you know, I think it's horrible, but I'd be willing to try anything now. But there's also a lot of fear that it will lead to the kind of abuses that Iraqis have seen during the past 14, 15 months, arbitrary detentions, searches and seizures, people being held without charges, a lot of things that have been happening, you know, that people want to have stop and that people were hoping would stop once they got an Iraqi government.
Does the new Iraqi government even have enough soldiers or policemen to enforce a martial law, to enforce curfews, let's say?
Well, it's an interesting question because I believe that they probably do, but the question is whether they have enough control over those soldiers and over those Iraqi Civil Defense Corps and even over the Iraqi police, because there have been so many cases where the Iraqi police or soldiers or ICBC will lay down their arms and join the insurgents. And so I think that's probably why they included a provision in the emergency law that Alawi can take control and can take direct command over security forces.
Anya, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Anya Seslado of the Christian Science Monitor speaking to us from Baghdad.
Just ahead, a hero of the SARS epidemic is detained in China for speaking out once again.
And later, losing ground in the worldwide war on AIDS because of a lack of medical personnel and an increase in the use of intravenous drugs.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Jennifer Westaway.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
In Hong Kong, political fallout from last year's SARS outbreak. The territory's health chief has resigned after facing harsh criticism for the way he handled the epidemic. A legislative report released this week said the health secretary, Dr. Yeo Eng Kong, did not pay enough attention to SARS when it appeared in mainland China in 2003. The report also said the health chief made statements that misled the public. SARS infected nearly 1,800 people in Hong Kong. 299 people died. Health officials were able to contain the outbreak, but not before it sent Hong Kong into an economic crisis.
When China lied to the world about its SARS epidemic, he told the truth. Now Jiang Yanyong is in detention for speaking truth to power once again, this time about the massacre in Tiananmen Square. The 72-year-old surgeon is a hero to many for the countless lives he saved by exposing China's attempt to hide its SARS outbreak. But to Chinese authorities, Jiang Yanyong has become a dangerous critic in need of re-education. Reporter Philip Pan is covering the story for The Washington Post. He joins us from Beijing. Philip, what have authorities done with Jiang Yanyong?
Well, Dr. Jiang was detained on June 1st in the days before the anniversary of the Tiananmen massacre and he's being held under 24-hour supervision somewhere in Beijing. We don't know exactly where. And according to what we've understand, he's being forced to take indoctrination classes, and they're questioning him quite aggressively about the letter he wrote recently about Tiananmen Square.
Is that a form of brainwashing?
Well, some people describe it as such. The government prefers to call them study sessions. It just depends on the level of pressure that's applied, I think.
What do they do? How does he spend his days?
Well, that's, we don't have a lot of details. We haven't been allowed to see him, and the government hasn't been very forthcoming about his status.
Has there been any communication from him since he was detained?
There's been no communication from him to the public. There have been a few handwritten notes that the authorities have shown his family, in which he says he's fine and that he's going to continue to deal with the problems facing him. He uses the phrase, to seek truth through facts, which the family interprets as that he's not backing down.
That's quite a courageous voice to find at age 72. How are his wife and children taking things?
His wife is said to be quite terrified and quite nervous about the situation. She was detained as well on June 1st and held for about 2 weeks before she was released. He has two children, one who's a doctor here in Beijing, another who's a computer programmer in California, a daughter, and both of them are quite concerned about the situation.
Now, nobody detained Dr. Jiang after he blew the lid off the SARS cover-up. What did he say about the Tiananmen massacre that did prompt a response?
In many ways, the Tiananmen massacre is one of the most sensitive subjects in Chinese politics. What he said simply, he just simply described what he saw that night in terms of he was the chief of surgery of an army hospital, and he described seeing scores of people coming into the hospital with bullet wound injuries. He described those injuries, and he basically called for the government to admit it made a mistake by doing this. He's a longtime party member, and he feels very strongly that for the party to continue to govern in the interest of the people in China, that it needs to acknowledge this is a terrible mistake.
But also, as a longtime party member, he must have known he was taking a risk. Why do you suppose he did it?
There are different accounts of this. Many of his friends urged him not to do this. They thought it would be too dangerous. But he's written letters about this before in the past, which haven't gotten any results, nor have it gotten him in trouble. But what's been said is that he felt that by speaking out during the SARS crisis and surviving that, he had accumulated a great deal of political capital, that it be because of his prestige that he accumulated, because of the public recognition, that he wanted to use that sort of power that he had developed to try to help the people who had suffered in Tiananmen.
Mm. Now, in addition to the risk that Dr. Jiang has taken, have the Chinese authorities themselves not taken a bit of a risk? I mean, by treating him this way, he is a hero to many.
Yeah, this is definitely a risky move on the part of the Chinese government. They have to consider the possibility of quite a public backlash, both internationally and domestically. Although Dr. Jiang isn't a household name, really, in China, he's still very well known. For a period of time, the Chinese media were describing him as a hero and were allowed to report on him. So quite a number of people know about him. And if the news about his detention spreads, it could really undermine the government's reputation.
Do the Chinese people even know he's in detention? What has state media done with this story?
It hasn't been mentioned at all in state media. Obviously, some people in China know that he's been detained because they have access to foreign media. They read the Internet. But I would think it's fair to say the vast majority of Chinese do not know that he's been detained.
What kind of payoff does the Chinese government expect to get out of this? They're taking a bit of a gamble if the story does spread and people learn of what has happened to Dr. Jiang. What will they gain?
I think that's a very good question. I think the way to look at it is there are two things. One, they would silence a very powerful critic who's raised an issue that they would rather not deal with, that has the potential to really divide the government and undermine the interests of particular leaders in the government who have came to power after Tiananmen. That's one. I think the other thing that does is if they can prove that they can move forward and arrest a man like Dr. Jiang, who has such a reputation internationally and domestically, then it sends a real message to other potential critics of the party in China that no one is really safe, that no matter how well-known you are, or how respected you are internationally, that the party can and is willing to still move against you if you go across the line that they've drawn.
Philip, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Philip Pan is the Beijing bureau chief for the Washington Post. He joined us from Beijing.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on things you hear on the program. You can send an email to letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
Please remember to tell us your town and how to pronounce your full name.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, a new study looks at the effect of working long hours on nurses.
And Kabuki Theater, how will this 17th century Japanese art form play in 21st century United States? That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jennifer Westaway.
It's Here and Now.
The AIDS epidemic is gathering speed. New figures from the United Nations AIDS program show a record 5 million new HIV infections in the past year alone, a quarter of them in Asia. The numbers come in advance of the 15th International AIDS Conference, which begins this weekend in Thailand. Worldwide, 38 million people now carry the virus, but even if every single patient had access to medication, global treatment could still fail. That's the conclusion of an Institute of Medicine report. James Curran is dean of the Emory University Rollins School of Public Health and co-author of the report. Dr. Curran, what's the biggest obstacle now to treating HIV/AIDS in developing countries?
I think the major concern about moving forward is that there are huge workforce shortages, as well as a need to improve the infrastructure for providing care.
Workforce, you're talking about healthcare workers.
I think healthcare workers, laboratory workers, those who manage the logistics and monitoring of programs, people throughout the supply chain, as well as those actually providing care.
What has changed about the treatment of AIDS that makes that a particularly acute shortage now in developing countries?
I think we've seen enormous brain drain and diversion of health resources from rural areas to urban areas, and healthcare workers themselves becoming sick and leaving many of the countries. The WHO estimates that only 7% of the people in urgent need of care for AIDS in the developing world are receiving it. That is about 400,000 of the 6 million people who need care now. And the availability of less expensive drugs that are effective provides the promise for treatment for many of these people.
Are they, in fact, living longer now?
Well, I think those, the small number who are receiving treatment, have had dramatic turnarounds, and this includes healthcare workers themselves who are infected with the virus.
What are some of the ideas that you floated in the report for getting that trained medical staff in particular to developing countries?
We thought that there needed to be concentrations in training healthcare workers and lab workers and others, as well as providing partnerships between institutions from developing countries and developed countries. The committee felt that an AIDS Corps, something along the lines of the Peace Corps for global AIDS efforts, would be one possibility.
Who do you think would volunteer for an AIDS-type Peace Corps?
I know that many graduate students in public health, medical students, nursing students, laboratory technicians, many people who have devoted their careers thus far to dealing with the AIDS epidemic would relish an opportunity to provide assistance to those countries in greatest need.
Dr. Curran, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
James Curran is the dean of the Rollins School of Public Health at Atlanta's Emory University and co-author of the new Institute of Medicine report.
Well, in the race against AIDS, Indonesia is heading quickly and decidedly in the wrong direction. HIV infection in this island nation has been historically low, but last year saw a 62% increase in cases, prompting the World Health Organization to move Indonesia ahead of China and Thailand as a top priority in the ongoing effort to fend off the world's next AIDS nightmare. But AIDS activists in Indonesia are finding themselves in both a health and a culture war, clashing with the country's Muslim fundamentalists. Joining us on the line from Jakarta is Elizabeth Pazani, AIDS specialist for Family Health International. And Elizabeth, why is this crisis in Indonesia so serious and so sudden?
It's really being driven by injection drug use. There's been a very, very large rise in the proportion of young people who are using drugs, particularly heroin. That rise in drug use is now translating into a rise in HIV in commercial sex. And so that provides an open door for the virus to go from the injection drug use population into a much wider population.
And we remember, too, that former dictator Suharto ruled Indonesia with a pretty iron hand. And after he was deposed in 1998, there was some loosening of restrictions, but that's also led to this health crisis. As a health worker, what are your biggest impediments to getting a message out in Indonesia?
The biggest impediment is probably a lack of political will at the very highest levels. But I should say, to be honest, it's not really a lack of awareness so much as a lack of a supportive environment and appropriate services for the populations that most need them.
And we understand, too, that there are many moderate Muslim groups who back public education and AIDS awareness, but that the minority fundamentalist group that's very vocal against any education is a pretty potent group. Can you give us an example of how a fundamentalist Islamic group might interfere with AIDS awareness education?
A very concrete example arose about a year and a half ago when the health ministry, together with programs supported by donor agencies, decided to promote condoms to a wider public through advertising, which was quite carefully targeted at men who were most likely to be the clients of commercial sex workers. One very small, very vocal religious group targeted the TV stations who were running the ads, wrote threatening letters to those TV stations saying, if you continue to run ads that promote condoms and destroy the morality of the people, then we can't answer for what will happen. And the TV stations, understandably, pulled the ads and refused to continue running them.
And we understand that one of the most vocal of the fundamentalist groups is the Mujahideen Council, which is led by Abu Bakr Basir, the man alleged to be behind much of the violence in the region, including the Bali nightclub bombing. So it would be understandable if people would react when that group protests.
That it is understandable. We haven't actually heard anything from that group for some time. And I have to say that many of the mainstream Muslim groups, in reaction to what happened with the earlier health promotion campaigns and condom promotion campaigns, have come out very, very forcefully in favor of public education campaigns. And in fact, many of the ads that were considered so threatening by the vocal minority led by the more extreme groups have now taken an active part in the condom and the safe sex promotion campaigns. So the ads that were pulled have been remade now with Muslim leaders actively promoting the messages of safe sexuality and responsible sexuality that the ads embrace. Mm.
Elizabeth Pazani, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Elizabeth Pazani, AIDS Specialist for Family Health International. She spoke to us from Jakarta, Indonesia.
still to come, the Archdiocese in Portland, Oregon, files for bankruptcy protection. What will it mean for the victims of clergy sex abuse?
And we speak with author Alex Garland, author of The Beach. His new novel is called The Coma.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Powwows used to be private, sacred affairs, strictly for Native people. But over the past several decades, many tribes have opened them up to the general public. The Okanichi Band of the Saponi Nation in North Carolina held their first public powwow 9 years ago as a way to win state recognition. Finally, 2 years ago, and after years of legal battles, the Okanichi Band became the eighth tribe to be recognized by North Carolina. Producer Keith Weston recently attended their spring powwow and offers these sounds.
My name is John Blackfeather. I'm a member of the Okanichi Band of the Saponi Nation. I'm a council member, and I'm known as a traditionalist. And basically what I do is do powwows.
Our ladies and gentlemen, our dancers are getting dressed. Takes them a little time to get the regalia on.
It's a homecoming. It's a gathering. It's a family reunion. It's a big church social, all of those wrapped up into one. We just get together, we dance, we sing, we do a lot of eating. We have beautiful vendors here.
I finally got here. You know, I'm really impressed.
Enjoy yourself.
Thank you.
We're going to kick today.
Okay.
These were closed many years ago to any outsiders. And only tribal members from other tribes were able to come, but they've opened it up to the public, and they are able to come in and share the culture with us and learn a little bit. Wherever we choose a spot to do, we rope off this circle, and that's our church. That's where we do our prayers and singing. And you may notice I had a sage, a bowl in my hand, and I walked in with the burning of the sage. We have four sacred herbs: sweetgrass, tobacco, sage, and cedar. This is a combination of four sacred herbs that we burn. We call it smudging. And smudging purifies.
Getting ready to do the smudging ceremony, I ask that you turn your cameras off. No filming of this ceremony here, please.
The circle is sacred to us. It's a sacred circle. I didn't attend powwows when I was a kid. Our culture was hidden from us. My father never started talking about it. He's 91 now. He started talking about it about 6 or 7 years ago when we were petitioning for state recognition. First time we recognized, I walked in and laid the bill on the table. I said, Dad, I said, now you can say you're an Okanichi Indian. Here's the paperwork. And he looked at me with a tear in his eyes. He said, 90 years I've had to deny my God-given right to be an Indian. And now my mother and father's gone. My brothers and sisters are gone. And here they finally concluded that we're Indian people.
We have our grand entry. Grand, big, exuberant. That's how dancers will be coming in full regalia. They'll make a couple of passes around.
When they come here and dance on this land here, they know that our people are under this ground. We're strong. You see them come out sweating, they ain't sweat. There's tears in their eyes. These boys cry when we dance, man. Whenever you set up a drum and two or three more people are singing, you got a powwow.
Sounds from the recent Okanichi Saponi powwow in Hillsboro, North Carolina. Our visit was produced by Keith Weston of WUNC in Chapel Hill.
More ahead on Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jennifer Westaway.
It's Here and Now.
The Catholic Archdiocese of Portland, Oregon, is filing for bankruptcy, the first in the country to do so in the face of mounting legal claims from sexual abuse victims. The move came yesterday, just as another lawsuit was set to begin. The Portland Archdiocese has already paid more than $50 million in claims to victims of abuse by priests. Archbishop John Vlasny says the church cannot afford to lose another big lawsuit.
Some would say I should have done this a year and a half ago. We've settled more than 100 claims. We've kind of emptied the pot.
Plaintiff James Devereaux says the church is not short of money, just ethics.
Today, the Archdiocese filed bankruptcy, but they've been morally bankrupt my entire life.
Fred Nafziger is a professor of business law at Indiana University South Bend. He joins us on the line. Professor, the lawyers for sexual abuse victims say the church in Portland has much more in assets than it's admitting. How do we define what an archdiocese is actually worth?
We don't know how much the church has in money. Just like you and I, churches keep their financial matters private. In this bankruptcy, it will be very revealing because the church will have to disclose to the bankruptcy court the nature and the extent of its assets, and we will find out for the first time what a church has in money, and we will learn whether or not it has enough money to pay its many creditors. It is likely to lead to a fight over matters related to what is church and what isn't. We tend to think of the church as a single institution, and what you might have in a diocese is a multiplicity of corporations. And so what we might find is the creditors arguing that this particular asset that's in the name of this one specific parish really belongs to the overall diocese and should be available to the creditors. And the church might argue, no, that parish is a separate legal entity, and that asset belongs to the parish, and therefore you creditors cannot have it.
There will be some form of argument in just what the church does and doesn't own, and probably will not get down to the level of closing schools and whatnot. But
correct.
In terms of the victims, the Oregon Church has already paid, I think it's some $53 million out to sexual abuse victims.
Yes.
What happens to the others whose lawsuits have not yet been settled?
One thing that is attractive to bankruptcy is it allows a defendant who's facing hundreds of lawsuits to bring a resolution. What will happen in the bankruptcy is a certain amount of money will be set aside for future awards. We don't know how many victims that will be. We don't know how much money that will be set aside.
A final question for you here. There are other archdioceses, of course, in Boston, in Tucson, and in Dallas that considered bankruptcy. What effect do you think this situation in Portland is going to have on them?
If this bankruptcy is smooth and fast, say it gets done in 30 to 36 months, if the parties are able to work things out, if the sexual abuse victims become a little more reasonable in their financial demands, and it sets a good pattern, then other churches might do it. Bankruptcy is no longer just a threat.
Lots of eyes on Portland, Oregon.
Yes.
Professor, thank you very much for this.
Thank you for having me.
Fred Nafziger is a professor of business law at Indiana University South Bend. We reached him in South Bend.
It can be hard to figure out what has meaning and what doesn't. This line from British author Alex Garland's new novella, The Coma, captures the plight of his protagonist and, at times, his readers. Fans of Garland's fiction seem to enjoy that foggy place between what's real and what isn't. The vagabond backpackers in his debut novel, The Beach, connected with Gen Xers, critics, and Hollywood. Leonardo DiCaprio starred in the movie. Then Garland's screenplay for the box office hit 28 Days Later imagined a Britain overrun by plague-ridden zombies.
It started as writing, and right from the beginning you knew this was different. Because it was happening in small villages, market towns. And then it wasn't on the TV anymore. It was in the street outside. It was coming through your windows. It was a virus. Infection. You didn't need a doctor to tell you that. It was the blood. Or something in the blood. By the time they tried to evacuate the cities, it was already too late. The infection was everywhere.
A scene from 28 Days Later by Alex Garland. His new novella is called The Coma, and Alex Garland joins us in the studio to talk about it. Hello.
Hi.
Well, I want you to do this first. You tell me what The Coma is about.
Okay, so it's a very simple story. A guy on a subway train late at night gets beaten up, put in a coma. And from that point, what you really have is the story of a coma from the perspective of the patient. And that just interested me as an idea. It interested me that you wouldn't reveal at the end, this is all a dream, but actually the protagonist would know right from relatively early on that this is a dream and a coma. And he's got this rather strange job to do, which is to wake up.
Right, and get out of it. I read that you once said that a teacher had told you that that would be a very bad way to write, to say at the end, this is all a dream.
Yeah, it was about cliches and avoiding cliches. And there's something about that that just pushed a button in me. Mm-hmm. I was only 14 or 15, but I'd never forgotten it. But there was another thing as well, I think, which is that dreams are something that we have every night. Our vocabulary about them is very limited. We can say that something's dreamlike, but we don't really have specialized words to describe this place that we spend a lot of time.
Yeah. In fact, in the book, the character sort of sums up his predicament in his dream, in his coma. Can you read that for us? It's on page 131. It's almost a laundry list in that very spare writing that you apply in this book.
Sure. It had all worked out like this. I'm attacked. I fall unconscious. I think I wake. The world is fractured and weird. I think I'm traumatized. I think I'm brain damaged. I realize I'm neither. I'm in a coma. I realize I have to wake, so I plan.
And in this plan, tell us, what did he do?
Well, he's not a doctor. He doesn't have any specialized knowledge. What he has is the kind of layman's guide to waking out of a coma, which we've seen from films or books or maybe anecdotally. You revisit memories, you listen to favorite pieces of music or read passages from books.
There's a funny moment where he's trying to sing the Sloop John B. again in his coma.
He goes to a record store, to try and track down some Little Richard and some Beach Boys to sort of trigger childhood memories of music that he'd heard. And he can't remember the lyrics properly,
The whole book, again, being so much in someone's mind is so much a part of what a lot of young writers are trying to do today, the idea of, you know, films starting at the ending and then going back. And were you looking to do that too, trying to get to something that you haven't seen before, that you haven't read before?
There is something very odd about this that I've been trying to figure out, which is that I actually started writing this like a year and a half ago. And at the point it's come out, there's already been, in the last few months, a few films and books that deal with internal life. And a film called Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind is one of them. And there's actually a whole bunch coming as well. There's a film called Stay, which is yet to be released. And I find it very strange because it makes me think that at the moment there's something slightly zeitgeisty. There's something in the ether or whatever it is about these internal worlds. And I just wonder what it is. And the film I'd worked on before this was called 28 Days Later. And it was a very kind of paranoid, dark film in a lot of ways or in all ways. And I just wondered if the amount of generalized paranoia in the air was making people retreat into themselves. It's hard to tell what triggers it because it seems so unlikely that a whole bunch of people whose job is figuring up stories would all come up with the same thing at the same time. But they clearly have. It's demonstrable.
Well, yours has something theirs doesn't have. We want to point out yours is an illustrated novella. You wanted it to read sort of like a comic book, and it has these woodblock illustrations made by your father, Nicholas Garland. He's an artist and political cartoonist for The Telegraph in Britain, highly respected.
Yeah, I'd grown up watching my dad draw every day. I'd wanted to be a cartoonist myself. I'd always thought that's what I would be. My route into writing books was through comic books. I used to draw them, used to write them as well. And the truth is that the way Dad draws and the way he cuts wood is sort of the way I write as well. It's got a lot of blanks in it. It forces the reader or the viewer to sort of make their imagination work.
Alex Garland, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
The book is called The Coma.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jennifer Westaway.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.